Here we come, walking down the street. We get the funniest looks from everyone we meet. Hey, hey, we're the monkeys, and people say we monkey around. But we're too busy singing to put anybody down. We go where we want to, do what we like to do. The only time to get restless, there's always something new.
That's right, we are the Monkees. Welcome, this is Scared Monkees Radio, where our webpage is located at www.scaredmonkees.com/radio. We're on Channel 46 on Trust Cable in Alabama, on satellite virtual channel W3957, and beautiful DigiCypher 2 audio on the podcast or wherever you can pick us up. Welcome. My name is Dana Pretzer. Tonight, Tim Miller from Texas EquiSearch will be here to talk about their involvement in the Kelsey Smith search and investigation. Turned out to be a tragic ending, but Texas EquiSearch, again, is there to help. We're also going to talk about the deepwater search for Natalie Holloway. After that, Robert Peters, the president of Morality in Media. And then Jenna Smolinski will be here. Her son, Billy Smolinski, William Smolinski, has been missing from Waterbury, Connecticut since August 24, 2004. There are some answers in this case. This isn't the first time that we've covered this, and she'll be here to talk about buried secrets. It's a fascinating story, and it's one that you can't miss here on the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkees Radio. We'll be back in a couple of minutes with Tim Miller from Texas EquiSearch.
Hey, we're
stand in line until you think you have the time to spend an evening with me. And if we go someplace to dance, I know that there's a chance you won't be leaving with me. Then afterwards we drop into a quiet little place and have a drink or two. Then I go and spoil it all by saying something stupid like I love you. I can see it in your eyes that you despise the same old lies you heard the night before. And though it's just a line to you, for me it's true and never seemed so right before. Every day to find some clever lines to say to make the meaning come true. But then I think I'll wait until the evening gets late and I'm alone with you. The time is right, your perfume fills my head, the stars get red and oh, the night's so blue.
All right, we're back. This is Scared Monkees Radio. My name is Dana Pretzer. Tim Miller from Texas EquiSearch is a regular guest on the program. It's always nice to have him. Kelsey Smith was murdered by a guy by the name of Edwin R. Hall. Texas EquiSearch was part of the investigation, and I thought I'd bring Tim Miller on to talk about that and talk about the deep water search for Natalie Holloway. Hi, Tim. Nice to have you on again.
Hi, Dana. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you for coming on. I know you're tired and I know you're busy. Kelsey Smith, another sad case. Tell us about Texas EquiSearch's involvement.
Well, we got that call to come up there and help, and, you know, that was, of course, a huge case up there. And we was on the very first flight the next morning and went up there and started getting things mapped out and stuff. But, you know, when I seen that one in the very beginning, Dana, when they had surveillance of the car leaving the Target shopping center, and then the guy that was, you know, basically stalking her. Mm-hmm. And then the car showing up across the street at Macy's 2 hours later. I knew that this wasn't one of them that we need to get involved with putting flyers out. This was one we need to just hit the ground running and start a search. And the writing was all over the wall that she was not alive. I mean, these are after doing almost 700 cases, you can almost determine what the outcome is going to be. And I've got to have to give so very much credit to law enforcement agencies from different agencies, different jurisdictions that worked together so very, very hard for one reason, and that was to find Kelsey. And I was in the command center there at the tower out there that they got the ping off of, and it was incredible the technology that they used out there. That detective actually drew a little pie shape going from the tower out, and I learned a lot on this case. And it's the farther you get away from the tower, the less strength the phone has on the tower. And I mean, they got us within a 4-acre radius where Kelsey's body was found. And I remember we was walking through that field and stuff, and seeing these tire tracks and in the grass, and you could see which way they was coming from, and there hadn't been any rain, and it was pretty obvious that somebody had driven through there within the last 3 or 4 days, and Kelsey's body was found, just ahead of that stuff. And it was just a tremendous effort on everybody's part. And the next morning I woke up at the hotel and turned the coffee pot on, and I remember on the very first conference I went to in Washington, D.C. on missing exploited children, that when President Bush made that opening statement that our children only make up 25% of our population, but 100% of our future. And, Edwin Paul decided that he was not going to allow Kelsey to be part of our future, and it's just a terrible, terrible loss for the family, the community, and just everybody. And, it's very, very sad, but we... again, that's what searchers. We do a good job out there. But you know what? We have compassion for the families, and we do have real tears at the end of these searches. And they just touch our hearts. And I guess when they quit touching our hearts, then maybe that's time to shut the doors. But it looks like we're going to be here a while.
Well, and I think you said it best. You have the cell phone ping, the triangulation. All of a sudden, you're seeing tire tracks where tire tracks aren't supposed to be, Tim. You must have that sick feeling in your stomach that you know that this isn't going to turn out good. Tell us from the perspective of a searcher. I'm looking at a picture right now of Kelsey, a beautiful young girl, has her life taken from her from this piece of garbage, this Hall character. How do you feel as an investigator, as a searcher, when you know that there's going to be a bad conclusion? And you were right, I think it was within minutes that you found her, correct?
Right. And it's one of them things, and I have to think about this too. I remember every minute of the 17 months that my own daughter Laura was missing.
Right.
And whether we want to believe it or not, I mean, I know this for a fact. There's one thing worse than having a murdered child, and that is probably knowing they're dead out there somewhere and never being able to say goodbye. So, a family never has the opportunity to go through the grieving process and the healing process until they know. And we knew in Kelsey's case, the quicker we find her, the better chance there's going to be some evidence there that they can determine the cause of death. And many, many families don't have that opportunity. So as bad as it is, which it's terrible, I mean, I don't want to sugarcoat it by any means, but they've got somebody in custody. They've got enough evidence. They know that it's the cause of death, and they can put this guy away for life. And now it's time for us to support that family through this grieving process, and hopefully they'll get that healing process. But there's a guarantee that their life will never, ever, ever be the same. There's always going to be that empty plate at that table that nobody can fill. We was just as determined. I think everybody there was just determined to go ahead and get her found. And again, we just cannot give enough credit to law enforcement up there and all the volunteers and all the people that law enforcement brought in. And I wish every law enforcement agency in the United States of America would have been there on that search because they could have learned something. And you know what? I want to say something about the state of Kansas. We have been up there three times within the last 6 months, and Jody Sanderholm case, and then the girl up there in Coffeyville, and now Kelsey, and state law enforcement agents in Kansas are relentless. All three of them cases came to a close quickly. They made arrests. They stopped their lives when these girls disappeared. And they're just incredible, incredible law enforcement agents in the state of Kansas. And and you know what? Speaking of Jody Sanderholm's case, that we went up there and located her car under the water in record time. Jody's family was coming down there to help us on that search. They'd been through this less than 6 months ago and stuff, and they knew what this family was going through, and they called me up and said, would you mind if we come down and help? We want to help find this girl. And I mean, it's just so heartwarming when these things, I mean, I'm choked up now, and it's so heartwarming when these other families that have went through this are willing to go out there and help these other families that are going through it now. And you know, together we're making a difference. I mean, together we're all making a difference.
Absolutely, and the compassion and dedication, and like you say, a family that just went through this, you know, 6 months ago, wanting to come down and help. Well, that's beyond words. Let's talk a little bit about the Holloway deep water search that's going to be coming up, Tim. I saw you on Hannity and Combs here a couple of weeks ago, and I thought that was a very unfortunate interview. You kind of got caught between the eyes, I think, with something.
They, you know what? They tried to catch me between the eyes.
Yeah.
Yeah, this planned search, or this search planned for, you know, way, way over a year, and we tried to make it happen last May, and some, you know, difficulties came up and stuff, and, you know, I got to do, so they got a forensic psychologist and stuff. That has no
bearing
on why we're doing this search. And we are actually going to Aruba, and we'll be there by the end of this month. And we've got a 265-foot ship.
Wow.
And then also a 340-foot ship that has all the equipment and everything on it. And the owner of this company has ships all over the world. He talked to Dave Holloway. I was at the owner's house. We're going to disclose his name next week because you're going to be doing an interview with him.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
And but anyhow, I was at his house last week having lunch and going over the final preparations for the search. And we called Dave Holloway, and he stayed on the phone with Dave for probably 30 minutes and stuff. And he made a promise to Dave that if Natalie is out there in that deep water, like we think that she is, and she's in a container, that with these ships and the technology on these ships, we're going to bring her home. And again, we are so blessed with these resources that we've developed over the years. And you know what? The owner of these ships, again, he's got them all over the world. He does a lot of underwater oil field stuff. And he charges $150,000 to $200,000 per day per ship, you know, depending on what size it is. And here's somebody that has opened up his heart to take them over there.
Wow.
Do the search free. And, you know, we look around about, you know, all these scumbags in the world and stuff, but, you know, if we sit back and look at all the good people that are trying to make a difference, you know, it's overwhelming. I mean, I've been so very, very blessed. You know, the best people in the world. And it only happened because of Laura's death.
Right.
You know, if Laura was still alive, I wouldn't be where I'm at now. And because of her death, all the wonderful, wonderful people I've met, you just can't explain it. I mean, I've been very, very, very blessed. I miss her. I love her every day. But you know what? I look back and say, Laura, your death wasn't in vain. We've made a difference. We have made a difference.
Well, and you're making a difference every day, every case. But when that phone rings and you head wherever, and I'm sure it's going to ring, maybe even tonight, you must get that feeling like, oh no, here we go again. But there's that drive, that dedication. Tim, what keeps you going on this? I know your daughter, and I know you've worked so hard, but let's talk about that.
You know what I think, and we never start a search without a prayer, and I am a God-fearing man, and you know, he deserves all the credit. He does. I mean, we've had on our searches now, ex-church members of, or volunteers have located remains of 67 people, and many, many of them would never have been found. I think we've got that additional guidance from God that keeps us going. And there's times I just want to quit. I want to throw my hands up and quit. It just gets me emotionally. It gets me financially to the point that, you know, is it worth it? Are we ever going to get the funding to really make this thing work? And, you know, the stress factors involved. But you know what? When you get that phone call from that parent saying, please help, you just reach deep down inside of you and pull out some strength that you just didn't think you had. And then you know what you do? You go to your barn. And I've got a barn in my backyard with my stereo in it. My horse is back there. And then you go to your barn and you take a six-pack of beer and listen to music and shed some tears and try to grieve these losses and then go on to the next one.
Wow. You know, that's unbelievable. Just before I let you go, Tim, and again, I really appreciate you coming on, you're looking at heading to Aruba at the end of the month, but how long do you think you'll be there?
I think, Dana, that within, you know, I hate to make predictions, but
right.
You know what, I think within 10 days, if Natalie is there in a container, we are going to bring that little girl back home to Alabama. I mean, that was our mission 2 years ago. It's one of them cases. It's not because it's a high-profile case. You know what? All the poor families and stuff we look for, we put just as much effort into. And this is another case of a beautiful young girl that really didn't do anything wrong. She went there for a high school graduation. And my God, I remember things that I did after high school and things that, you know, we all put ourselves at risk at some point in time. But somebody made a choice to do something in Natalie Holloway. I don't have any doubt in my mind that it wasn't Yorin Vandersloot. And I don't have any doubt in my mind right now. And I've been wrong before, but I said it was Paula Vandersloot that made the arrangements to take her, having her taken out to sea. And you know what? We're just driven on bringing her back.
Yeah.
And how can you put a timeline on it? I don't know, but what's the size of these ships? What's the technology that we're going over there with? We're optimistic. I mean, these ships are actually equipped with a special air tanks and everything that at 1,000 feet, they can send divers down. It's just an incredible, incredible company that's offering our services. And again, you're going to be interviewing them next week, and it's something we've wanted to make happen. And for somebody to step forward, that I've been talking with him since December, actually, and to say, hey, let's go help. And Dave Holloway called me back after I left his house, after I left his family's house with the ship last week. And Dave said, have you ever seen anybody my age do a backflip? And I said, no. He said, well, I did one after talking to that man. It's incredible. And again, God has just blessed us with all these wonderful, wonderful people that have big hearts and want to make a difference.
Well, God bless you, Tim. And let's hope the very first day that you're in Aruba, you find Natalie and we can bring her home. I'll stay in touch.
Let's bring her home,
yeah.
And let's go to that funeral and let's just support that family. Again, you know, I'm going to say this one more time, man, before I close. Again, there's one thing worse than having a murdered child, and that's knowing they're out there dead someplace.
Absolutely.
Never being able to say goodbye. And you know what? We need to do everything we can to give Dave and Beth that opportunity to take us.
Absolutely. Thank you, my friend. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Dana.
Take care. Bye-bye. Tim Miller from Texas EquiSearch. And, you know, when you see the news broadcasts and the media and what's going on, and Paris Hilton crying, Mommy, when she's in handcuffs going back to jail, that makes me want to puke. But when I hear this man, the kindness, the compassion, and the drive to help other people, That makes me smile. My name's Dana Pretzer. This is Scared Monkeys Radio Network. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. My name's Dana Pretzer. A federal appellate court in New York stunned the Bush administration and the FCC by ruling that it's okay for broadcasters to allow fleeting expletives to air with impunity. The decision could possibly gut the ability of the FCC to regulate any speech on radio or TV. Robert Peters, the president of Morality in Media, joins me today. Nice to have you back on the show, sir.
Thanks for having me back.
A lot of people will say, what is a fleeting expletive and how important or how devastating is this court ruling?
Well, I'll answer the second question first. How devastating is the court ruling? And it's hard to, at one level, it's a hard question to answer. But on its face, the court in New York City, the Federal Court of Appeals, it was a very narrow decision that the court came down with.
2-1, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, but yeah. A couple of years ago, the FCC changed a specific policy regarding enforcement of the broadcast indecency law, in specifically in relation to how it would treat isolated expletives or fleeting expletives.
Right.
And the court decision that came down earlier this week determined that the FCC had not adequately justified the change. You know, under administrative law, agencies can change their policies, but they've got to justify them. And two judges didn't think that the FCC had done enough. One judge, thankfully, thought they had. I'm not an expert in administrative law to know whether the two judges or the one judge were right, but I'll tell you, my own personal feeling is that the FCC could do a much better job of justifying its decision to treat single four-letter words as a violation of the law in appropriate circumstances. I also think if they were to do that they should provide some clarification so that broadcasters have some sense when they're beginning to get into, you know, walk on thin ice. Certainly FCC isn't proposing that every single expletive is a per se violation of the law. So they need to provide some guidance. And I tell you, I'd love the job of justifying this change. I'd show how the content, the standards of broadcasting, particularly on television and some of the radio shock jocks, have just plummeted. You know, what might have been true in 1978 when the Supreme Court talked about an isolated expletive is no longer the world we live in.
Exactly.
So I think the FCC is on solid ground, but what they're going to do, I don't know. And, of course, one never knows what the Supreme Court will do if it ultimately comes before the Supreme Court.
Some examples that are used in the story that I read are NYPD Blue, for example, and the character Dennis Franz played of Andy Sipowicz. An excellent program. It was played a little bit later on in the evening, one that your children probably shouldn't sit and watch. But how necessary was it to drop that that four-letter word in the show? I'm not sure that it was, and you make a good point. How did the FCC maybe drop the ball when they made their presentation to the court, and what could they do to make it better?
Well, I'll tell you, specifically with the NYPD Blue, they actually, the FCC reversed itself on that particular determination before this court decision came down. They, there was an earlier remand in this proceeding, and the FCC determined that it had not followed proper procedures with the NYPD Blue case, and so they dropped it. But, in reading their order, the FCC's order, caught my attention was that when they had originally determined that NYPD Blue had violated the law, they noted that this same word kept coming up over and over and over again in various episodes. And, you know, which gets me, you know, kind of like one of my points is, what are you talking about when, you know, what is an isolated expletive
exactly.
in a medium where cursing has become so common? I mean, is it every 5 minutes or 10 minutes okay every 15 minutes to say the F word or 25 minutes? I mean, back in 1978, there was very little cursing on television, and with the exception of probably one or two radio programs, virtually none on radio. And so for the court to talk about an isolated expletive, you know, made sense in 1978. Today, it's almost an oxymoron. So if I were to justify the change in policy, you know, why should the FCC be able in certain circumstances to treat a single four-letter word as a violation of the broadcast indecency law? I'd make the argument that because standards in broadcasting have plummeted, and you can't really talk realistically anymore about an isolated expletive. I mean, some dramas, there isn't one episode where they don't let go at least one, and
yeah.
often two or three or four. Four-letter words. So talking about isolated expletives when it comes to at least some parts of broadcasting just doesn't make sense. We need a new policy. And I personally think if the FCC would do its job, it would stand a very good chance of having its having both the law as a whole and the policy stand up before the Supreme Court.
You bet. And it's a big, broader picture. Let's talk about live broadcasts. And with the Super Bowl and all this and the delay mechanisms that they can implement through technology, how have media been doing with that? Have they been living up to their standard? I get so tired of hearing this free speech claim for every time some shock jock or some idiot goes off the deep end on air and they claim free speech. That's not what free speech is all about, in my opinion.
Well, not in my opinion either. With the live programming, I kind of make a distinction between, you know, a program where there really has never been a problem with somebody saying some four-letter word or a few of them, and suddenly out of nowhere it happens. And nobody anticipated it. At one level, nobody had any reason to anticipate it. And, in a circumstance like that, I would be strongly inclined, if I were a hypothetical FCC commissioner, to say that we're not going to hold the station liable for that, you know. But with something like, you know, these Hollywood, you know, or entertainment industry award programs, just unbelievable, the horrible, filthy things that come up in these programs. And, I mean, you know, the networks, in my opinion, are on notice. You're going to have a live program where entertainers are going to be honored. They're going to get a chance to walk up to that microphone when nobody is going to be able to prevent them from saying what they want. You know, that's a place to put it on delay. Talking about this issue to different radio people, some people who've been around for, you know, they said probably a lot of the radio stations have been using the delay mechanism for a long time.
Right.
I think it's about time the television networks start using a delay system too. When they have a program where there is a good reason to believe that somebody might say something that the network will later claim they regret was said. Well, if you really regret it, why don't you do something to prevent it from happening in the first place?
A lot of my listeners question this whole satellite via versus a regular broadcast, and as far as the openness or the no regulation on satellite broadcasts, the XM, the Sirius, for example, how can they do that? Because if you turn on your Sirius radio, I have one, I have young children, and you have to be very, very careful when you turn from channel to channel, because it's basically open season on garbage mouth on this satellite broadcast. What can be done about that, and why the difference?
Well, I tell you, the what you just described is why I think it there isn't any real difference between broadcasting via satellite versus broadcasting by traditional means.
Which, that's right, yeah.
You know, the towers. I mean, the one difference is that with satellite, you do sign up. With broadcasting, if people didn't buy the ads they saw, the broadcasters would go out of business. So one way or another, viewers pay for the programming. They buy a television or a radio, same expense. And the fact that, I mean, to me, it's what is often described as a distinction without a difference. Once a, you know, there might be an argument made when, you know, some specialty area media that very few people are interested in, the ones that are, perhaps an argument could be made, they're on notice that some pretty wild things go on in that particular form of media. But once a medium becomes popular, like satellite radio has become, I mean, it's not as big as regular broadcasting, but it's big, just as satellite television isn't as big as traditional broadcasting. But it's big, and all kinds of people are signing up for it, not because they want to listen to adult programming, but because they want to hear all the rest of the stuff. And I don't think they should have to be subjected to the likes of Howard Stern and Opie and Anthony. Now, I wouldn't ban Howard Stern and Opie and Anthony from satellite.
No.
I'd put them on a separate channel.
Yep.
And if you want it, as an adult, all you have to do is provide whatever proof of age will hopefully keep most of the kids away, and I wouldn't even charge for it. I'd just say, you want to listen to adult programming, we're going to put it all on this channel or these two channels if there's that much of it. And as an adult, all you have to do is subscribe. You know, I mean, to turn it around and to put all of the responsibility on people who don't want to be exposed to it, and particularly parents who are concerned about their kids, I just think that's not the way to go about it. And up until not too long ago, there wouldn't even have been a question as to whose responsibility should it be, the adult who wants the smut to sign up or parents who are trying to protect their kids to put up a shield. Until quite recently in our nation's history, this would have been a no-brainer. You, as an adult, are an adult, and you can sign up for that stuff. If you want to hear burlesque, you sign up.
Yep.
Not the job of parents to have to shield their stuff from their kids from stuff like that. But right now, we have a Supreme Court that seems not to know. In my opinion, they very much lost their moral guidance. You know, their moral course. They're blinded by ideology and have lost good sense.
Absolutely. Just before I let you go, we have elections coming up. Where do you see broadcasting standards, broadcasting regulations going if there's a huge change? Right now, it's been, I guess if there was a report card, I would give the Bush administration a C- as far as trying to regulate media, trying to protect our kids, as you and I have both spoken about. If there's a big change in government, do you see that changing? How involved will the courts be when it comes to broadcasting?
Well, it's a tough question. You know, historically, going back as far as Lyndon Johnson, the Democrats in the White House have not been friends of decency, of a decent society.
Exactly.
And I think the reason for that is because at the White House, I guess the president feels that he has to be particularly sensitive to the needs of the people who put him there. From my experience at Morality and Media, and I've been working here 22 years, I've never seen an awful lot of difference between Republicans and Democrats at the congressional level. You know, it's amazing. When the Democrats controlled, you know, Congress, in my opinion, they were just as open to laws about pornography and, You know, some of the strongest opponents of Boston Sea in recent years have been Democrats. So at the, you know, at the lower levels, I mean, thankfully, this, you know, I was, this isn't a partisan issue. You know, you don't have to be a Republican or a Democrat to either like or dislike pornography or four-letter words in television and sex and violence, you know. You don't have to be a person of one party or another to either oppose or support those things. But, I mean, just being speaking honestly, at this point in our history, a lot of the groups that defend the garbage tend to vote Democratic. And for some reason, that seems to have an impact on people in the White House. Doesn't have much of an impact on Congress, but it does have an impact on the White House. And certainly, you know, the president appoints at least names of individuals for federal court positions, Supreme Court. And in my opinion, the number one reason why we have so many of these problems are the courts.
Yeah.
And, if you know, depending on who we elect to office, it's going to, in large measure, determine the kind of judges we get. And it's the judges these days that are ruling the roost. In my opinion, it shouldn't be that way. You know, I mean, I don't believe that the Supreme Court should be the supreme branch of government. They're the Supreme Court. They're supposed to, you know, be the leading court in our system of government. They were never intended to be the supreme branch of government. But in many ways, they have become that. And their arrogance seems to know no end. Now, part of the answer to all of this is to put judges on the Supreme Court and the federal courts that understand what the word restraint means, that understand that when you put that judge's robe on, you put aside your personal views. It doesn't matter what Justice Stevens thinks about the First. It shouldn't matter what he thinks about this provision or that. It's not his job to impose his own personal views. But a lot of judges have come to think that they have a right to interpret law in accordance with their own personal opinions. And I don't care, you know, if whether it's the Democrats or the Republicans, if whoever will name judges to our courts who understand that that is not the job of the judge, I'll be all for them.
Well said. Robert Peters, president of Morality in Media. It's always nice to have you on the show. Thank you, sir.
Thank you for having me.
Take care. Bye-bye. And we'll be right back here on Scared Monkeys Radio. And that's right. Just before we do come back, I got to share this with you because it's driving me crazy. Comes from FoxNews.com. A screaming, weeping Paris Hilton was back in the slammer Friday after a judge ordered her to go back to prison to serve out the remainder of her 45-day sentence for a probation violation in a reckless driving case. Leaving the courthouse, Hilton shouted, "It's not right. Mom!" She called out to her mother in the audience. When you interview people like Tim Miller, or parents of missing loved ones or victims of crime. Janice Smolinski's coming up here in a couple of minutes. And you see the news coverage of a spoiled rich kid doing 45 days jail for a probation violation. She was put on probation because she was already given a break to cry out, "Mom!" And now the Paris Watch will be on Entertainment Tonight, the Fox News channels. I imagine Greta Van Susteren is covering it big time on her program tonight. Yet you hear about these other stories and it just drives you around the bend. It just drives you around the bend that the mainstream media, the cable news channels are covering this crap. Yet there are all these other missing people out there that deserve the time on air. It just drives me around the bend. You're listening to Scared Monkeys Radio. My name's Dana Pretzer. We'll be back in just a minute with Janice Smolinski.
Return to me, oh my dear, I'm so lonely. Hurry back, hurry back, oh my love, hurry back, I am yours. Return to me, for my heart wants you only. If I hurt you, I'm sorry. Forgive me. And and please say you are mine. Return to me. Please come back, bella mia. Hurry back, hurry home to my arms, to my lips and my heart.
Return.
Okay, we're back. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. My name is Dana Pretzer. I'm going to follow up on a story that we did a while back about William Billy Smolinski. And I ask you all to go to this webpage, www.justiceforbilly.com, and the four is the number four. So it's www.justice4billy.com. And there you'll learn about Billy Smolinski. He's been missing since the 24th of August, 2004. He was last described as being white with light brown hair, blue eyes, 6 foot, approximately 200 pounds, and he's missing from Waterbury, Connecticut. I've had his mom, Janice Smolinski, on with me in the past, and I bring her back again this evening. Hi, Janice.
Hi, Dana.
How are you doing?
Fine, thanks.
Now, obviously, there's been some updates, some changes in the case of your missing son. If you could you kind of reintroduce the case to my audience, and then we'll get into an article that I have in front of me that's not only very disturbing but fascinating, called Buried Secrets.
Okay. Billy went missing 2004 of August. He went to Florida for a week, came back, had some problems with his girlfriend. He found out that she was dating a... now resigned married politician, and they had a few problems. So apparently the neighbor next door said that Billy said he was going up north for a few days, which we knew there was a red flag right there.
Mm-hmm.
But when we told the police, they pretty much ignored it and said that we had to wait 3 days in order to report him.
Right.
Well, we waited the 3 days, and truck was parked at the end of the driveway, which was a red flag because he never parked it there. And, you know, all the different things that led up to it, the police just ignored it. And I guess because he was a missing adult, had a lot to do with it.
If I remember correctly, and I do remember your last interview with me very well, you were actually not able to talk about some things because there were some threats of litigation in front of you. And hopefully we can clear some of that up tonight. But it's almost a stigma for some law enforcement. In fact, you even see it on TV, that you get a young, healthy guy or a young, healthy gal in their 20s, 30s. All of a sudden, they're gone for a day or two. Ah, they must have just gone somewhere. They wanted to be alone. And the police really don't put a lot of effort into it. Is that more of a... Well, I'm going to use the term prejudice, or is it more of a lack of education?
I think it may be a little bit of both. Lack of education, maybe more. I think the police need to be educated along certain lines. They need to, I don't know. I just think they should evaluate every situation. With our case, you know, I know there are a lot of people that maybe they go on drug binges or, you know, but if they evaluate every case right at the beginning, because it's the first 48 to 72 hours, maybe even 24 hours, are the most important. And those are the hours that are ignored when it comes to missing adults. So, you know, we have a large, intact family, and we all rallied to this house saying that they're the problem, and they just ignored it.
Tell us about Billy.
I'm sorry?
Tell us about Billy.
Billy, he was a fun-loving guy. He was very, he liked people. If he had a problem with somebody, he would tell them he had a problem. But if he didn't, he'd be there for you no matter what. I mean, there were times where you would see him on the side of the road because he did drive a tow truck as one of his jobs,
mm-hmm.
changing a tire for someone just because he saw them having a problem, he'd pull over and change it. Mm-hmm. That's the type of person he was. So, you know, having this girlfriend, he felt sorry for her, and he fell in love with her. And that's what, he just made the wrong decision. And I'm not saying that she has anything to do with it, because I don't know.
Right.
You know, it's just that, you know, there were so many things that led up to it. I mean, the flyers that were being torn down for a year and a half, and we're putting them up on the pole, and she's taking them down. And we have videotape of all that, so I could say it, and we know it's her.
Right.
And she drives a school bus. But it just seems like the police ignored everything that we have, and I don't know why. And matter of fact, in the town over where she drives the school bus, the police department arrested me for hanging a flyer of my son on a telephone pole.
Wow.
And I was arrested as a criminal, and I had to go to Superior Court.
Whatever happened with that, Janice?
Well, they did nolly it. The prosecutor just couldn't believe what he read, and there are two charges on that that are completely false.
Mm-hmm.
That a journalist, an investigative and journalist, found out that two of the charges were completely false. So, you know, there are many red flags here, and we just, you know, we're in the dark. And then this, you know, with the newest article that just came out.
And I think that's a good time now to get into that, because we have a lot to cover with that. I'm looking at it, in fact, right now from the Waterbury Observer. It's an independent newspaper, a story from a fellow by the name of John Murray called Buried Secrets. Let's take it from where you're sitting in a Barnes & Noble cafe in downtown Waterbury from there.
Okay. Well, there was an FOI commission release.
And that's freedom of information for those that... I'm sorry, Janice, just to let my audience know.
Okay. Yes, the freedom of information release by Andy Thibault. He's a former FOI commissioner, and he asked for some parts of Billy's file going back a year ago, and they did not want to release them at that time, but he put in an appeal, and they finally did release them. And when we went to... There were... five journalists and a private investigator with us. And we met at Barnes & Noble, and reading through the report on page 14 was disturbing, because there was a tip a year ago in June. There was a tip called into Crime Stoppers that Billy was murdered by his girlfriend's son, which I could say because it's all public knowledge now. Now, this is just a tip. Now, we're not sure if it happened, but he was murdered by her son, and he's a construction worker, and they pulled him out and buried him and poured concrete over him the next day. So this was completely new to us. We never heard about it.
Law enforcement, no one has ever contacted you that this information had come forward?
Never.
Okay.
And this tip was called in a year ago, which I guess the police had met with him in the town, and they really didn't follow up on it very much, as far as we know. You know, it was just pretty much ignored.
One of the quotes in the article says, "With enough clues to send Sherlock Holmes into orbit, detectives inside the Waterbury Police Department told the Smolinskis that they suspected no foul play, and their investigation was stymied." How did you react to that?
You know, it was a lot of frustration. You know, we worked really hard for the past 3 years to get where we are now. And to hear this tip is just, you know, it's, I can't even believe it. You know, my husband and I just sat there, and we felt like, you know, somebody had punched us in the stomach. We just wanted to get up and run.
Right.
You know, we're sitting at the table with all journalists, and you know, I don't know. With the police department, you really feel like you could trust them. And we want to feel that way, but, you know, everything we've learned, and if anyone has a missing person out there, they really have to check up. You know, you really can't depend on them. My DNA was lost 3 times, lost or stolen. We don't know where it went. And every time we questioned them, they couldn't really tell us where it was. So they'd call us down again. And so it was a total of 3 times. And on the 3rd time, when I finally asked, where is my DNA, mine and my daughter's, I called the FBI. And they took control of it and took a mouth swab and sent it into the national database.
Now, have the FBI taken over this investigation?
Yes, they have completely taken over the investigation now.
Where has that investigation gone, and in particular the Crime Stoppers tip?
You know, they did have a dig. After the information came out, they dug in a few different areas, but with no results. FBI is very quiet, so I don't have any information as to what they're doing. I guess they like it that way. It's frustrating for us, but, you know, I guess this is their policy, so we have to follow through on it. They're very kind to us, but as far as offering any information, no, we don't know what's going on.
Have agents been in contact with you, even just to let you know that they're continuing on with the investigation?
Oh, we do keep in contact with the agents. Yes, we do. There's 2 of them that are very kind to us, so, you know, I realize that they have a lot of other things on their plate, too, not just Billy, you know. So, but I do feel that they are working on it.
Have the investigators, to your knowledge, spoken to any of the people involved, whether we call them suspects or not, I think is irrelevant, and have there been any consideration as far as polygraph tests?
That I don't know. When it was in the police hands, no. They gave none of them a polygraph test because they said they had lawyers. As far as the FBI goes, I don't know what they're doing. So I would hope to think that they are getting polygraph tests. I know it's not admissible in court.
Right.
But at least maybe it'll lead them in a direction.
Well, it's an investigative aid. And, you know, Janice, this must be just so incredibly frustrating. You mentioned that the reporters and the private investigator that are working with you, how have they been able to help or aid in the investigation?
Oh, if it wasn't for the media, we wouldn't have gotten anywhere. You know, they've been so helpful. All the journalists that sat with the table, John Murray, you know, he's with all his articles, and he's with us all the time. And TV stations, every time we need them or something comes up, they're right there. We just had a bill passed through the House of Representatives and then through the Senate, and it's on Governor Rell's desk. So, you know, as soon as the media picks up on it, they're right at our door, and it brings Billy's name out again.
What does that bill entail?
It's educating the police. It's making them so that they only have a few hours of schooling regarding missing persons when they go to police academy. What they need to do is learn about DNA and learn about it being entered into the national database. Sure, they took our DNA, but my DNA, but they didn't know what to do with it after that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just that, wherever. I had talked to a coroner in Vegas, and thank God for the internet, because I've really talked to a lot of different people throughout the country that actually educated me, and he told me that if your DNA isn't entered into the national database, then you might as well just throw it away. Well, that's what got me learning about DNA, and when I questioned the police, they didn't even know what CODIS was, and CODIS is the national database for the DNA, and so I really feel that they need to be educated. And it is a model legislation by the Department of Justice, and each state, we're trying to get each state to have the same type of model legislation, so everyone's on the same level, and it'll all connect dots. Kelly Jalkowski is, her son Jason is missing. She actually has a forum which has all the 50 different states, and she's trying to get, you know, each one to get a sponsor to for the model legislation.
Have the Waterbury Police Department members, chief, whoever, investigators, come back to you with any sort of explanation, or have they simply washed their hands of this now that the FBI have taken over?
The only thing that the chief of police, he was very kind, and he apologized. And he apologized because he himself was not sure about the national database CODIS system. And I just think he feels bad. Our case went through 6 detectives, and there was one that was very kind, and he tried very well, but... No, they didn't perform very well.
The bill, the education part of the training with the law enforcement officers, I think, is incredibly important. And you say that right now in the academy they only get a couple of hours or a few hours of training as far as missing persons go. Those are new officers that are in the academy, that are coming out of the academy. What about the old stymied veterans that have a mental block when it comes to this sort of progression in investigative techniques? Will this bill cover all members or just new officers?
No, this is all members.
Good.
I know that the older ones, they're set in their ways and they don't want to change. But no, this is going to, if we're 2007, we're in a technological age. And with CSI and all, Court TV and all the different shows on TV, unfortunately, the criminal is learning how to dispose of a person. And once they dispose of them, they're just a missing person. And, you know, so the police have to get a step ahead of them. And with the DNA, that they'll be able to, it'll be able to work better, you know. I just talked with a lieutenant up in Ohio yesterday. They had found remains, and Billy was top on their list as being the missing person that fit the criteria of these remains. Now, if the DNA system worked properly, they could have taken parts of this skeleton
exactly
and matched it up, but they're using dental records right now.
Mm-hmm. And have you had a report back on that?
Yes. Okay. Well, this person had 11 gold covers on his teeth, and Billy had no gold
okay.
on his teeth, so that eliminated him immediately.
If we could, Janice, just go back to the dig that they had. Was there any indication that there was anything there at any time, or was the Crime Stoppers tip ruled to be inaccurate?
We're not sure. The Crime Stoppers tip, they actually dug in a completely different area. So the tip that was given, they never dug there, and we're not sure why.
Wow.
But I suppose they know what they're doing, so they said that there were other tips that came in also.
But the Crime Stoppers tip that you saw, they never dug in that location?
No, they did not.
And did they give you any explanation why?
No.
Oh, jeez.
So, I know. That's what makes it so frustrating, you know, and we just can't sit back. We have to talk, and everything that we're saying is completely true, and it's written. So, you know, I wish we had more answers.
Well, we all wish that you had more answers, and this has been a mess for you, and, you know, my heart goes out to you and your family, and hopefully you'll be able to get some answers someday. Has the media said that they'd be doing any follow-up on the Buried Secrets story?
No, they haven't said it, but if there is anything, I'm sure they will be here. You know, I know we had a reporter from Channel 3 TV station, she sat down with us and she said that anything that the TV station could do for us ever, just ask. You know, so we are very grateful to all media. And, you know, I know someone out there knows something. And also, you know, if anyone has a missing person, within the past 3 years, we've really become educated along all these lines. So if anybody ever needs any help or you know, any input that I can help them with, they just get in touch with me.
Again, the webpage is www.justiceforbilly.com, www.justiceforbilly.com. Thank you, Janice.
Thank you so much.
And we'll stay in touch.
All right, thanks.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This is Scared Monkeys Radio. I'm Dana Pretzer. We'll be right back. That's it for this evening. Thank you all for listening. Thanks to Tim Miller, Bob Peters, and Janice Malinsky for dropping around. Again, I remind you, our webpage is www.scaredmonkeys.com/radio. That's www.scaredmonkeys.com/radio. There you can pick up the podcast of the show, listen to the daily commentaries, or whatever. We'll see you again real soon. And don't forget to go to scaredmonkeys.com for all your news and views. And don't forget, Paris called for her mommy before she went to jail. Thank you all. Good night.